Good morning. I'd like to call the BATA Oversight Committee of Wednesday, April 11, 2012 to order. Can we call the roll, please?
Morning, Commissioners. Chair Bill Dodd.
Here.
Vice Chair Tom Bates.
Here.
Commissioner David Campos. Commissioner Dave Cortese.
Here.
Commissioner Federal Glover.
Here.
Commissioner Steve Kenzie. Commissioner Bijan Sartipi. Commissioner Scott Wiener.
Present.
Present. Thank you. Commissioner Adrian Tissier.
Here.
Commissioner Amy Ryan Worth.
Here.
We have a quorum, Mr. Chair. And
fantastic.
Commissioner Campos is present. Thank you. As per policy, as authorized by state law, I am making the following announcement. Each member of the board here today will be entitled to receive $100 per meeting attended, up to a maximum of $500 per month per agency. This amount is provided as a result of convening a meeting for which each member is entitled to collect such amount. Thank you.
I'm sure the bankers are impressed. We have a consent calendar before us. May I have a motion to approve, please?
Move. Second.
We have a motion, a second. Any discussion? Any dissent? A motion passes without objection. We'll move now to item number three. It's a BATA resolution number 103. It's a financing plan. Morning, Brian.
Good morning, sir. Good morning, commissioners. I'm Brian Mayhew. I work in finance. Here to talk to you about resolution 103, which could conceivably be the last financing plan for the seismic retrofit program in all of our current toll bridge projects. On my left is Mary Collins, who is our bond counsel from Orrick Herrington, and somewhere on my right in a moment is Bob Rich, who is a partner at PFM, who has been the financial advisor with us for just about forever. Up in front of you, we got a small or brief presentation that we'll go through, and then we'll be happy to take your questions. Susan? Back one. There we go. Let's start with sort of where we began this. Actually, somewhere around is a PowerPoint of the very first BATA financing, which was $1 billion planned. The financing was split between Northern and Southern Bridge Groups. The treasurer was the issuer of record, and a lot of the parties. Interesting, and every one of the funds, as we went into that, showed major deficits in about 15 years. Since that first presentation at the state treasurer's office, we have sort of changed things around a bit. First of all, we have funded now, in the 11 years, very nearly $11 billion worth of projects. That's a lot of dirt and a lot of steel in a very short time. We have issued $8 billion in toll revenue bonds, $8.5 billion at the spans. Our current average cost of financing is about 4.47%, and we're going to get to a graph in a second where you'll see where that really sort of sits in. 90% of the seismic program is done, but more importantly, with everything done, our current models, financial models, which are predicated on 3% expense growth and relatively flat traffic and revenue. Actually, it's 0.5% a year. Actually shows that you won't have a toll impact until 2027. And that includes every one of these projects, this last plan financing, the establishment of our rehab program at about $60 million a year, fully funding the existing rehab program, and our operation and maintenance strikes, and maintaining all of our covenant coverages. And even if interest rates on what we have money, if the interest we earn on, or what we earn on our assets, should go up a bit, we can almost make that get a little longer away. So with all of that, we're just about to finish the program and right about where we promised it would be. We said we could do it with roughly $5, and we have done much more than was set out in 2005 with the $5. So that is something to look back on. During the Great Recession, I think I'll say that BATA was the only transportation entity to go from a negative outlook to stable. During the same period, we held all of our ratings, and we've been very proud of that as things have gone along too. And then the last parts of it is that we've basically switched over from to a relatively stable, roughly 77% fixed rate debt, and that's split between taxable debt, which is supported by the federal government, and standard tax exempt debt. Okay, that's the base. Now looking on to 2012. We had about $1.6 billion left over from our authorization in 2010, which we never utilized. We do project now that we'll need about $1.2 billion of that to finish out the program as it's planned. And so basically what we're going to do is we're going to use a good market and our market opportunities to finish all of our capital financing in the upcoming year. We do have some things that are going on in the market and continue to go on in the market even as we speak today. And one of them is that there is a new sort of round of bank downgrades. Even though the federal government just finished the stress tests on banks and declared them all relatively healthy or within their requirements, Moody's has come up with a new structure, and there's going to be some impact there, and we'll talk about that one in just a minute. Basically, what we are going to do during the year 2012 is continue to be very aggressive in preempting any credit risk that could come up, and we'll tell you about that one in just a second. And then there's the regular debt portfolio management. One of them will be to continue to monitor and manage our variable rate / swap portfolio of about $1.5 billion. We'll talk about that one in just a moment. But there, our plan is the same as it usually is that's to monitor it, look for opportunities, see what the market gives us. I will say going in, it is actually performing the way it was designed. The actual contract swap payments exceed the actual bonds covered by the swaps by about $2 million. That will change in any given year, but they are designed to offset each other, and that continues to go. The contracts continue to function. Payments continue to be made exactly the way the contracts were designed. Okay. The word opportunistically sort of is an important word here. As we go back to 2009, you can look at that top left corner of the chart, and you can see where indexes were when we were looking at 2009 and what we still had at that point, $5 billion of the program to finance and interest rates beginning to get at staggering levels. At those levels, we would not have finished the program. If they'd hit 6%, we wouldn't have finished it with the same toll structure. Our models, you see that gray line up there, that's 5.75%. That was our modeling target. At 5.75%, our feeling was we would make our plans, we would get the program finished within the structures we had. As you can see, when we set that target, we were actually below what the revenue bond index said we should have set it at, and our goal was to be aggressive. The gift we got from the federal government were those little dots, as you can see, that go below the revenue bond index. The revenue bond index, basically the index we'd have been issuing at. That is where the interest rate on the Build America programs came in. We never expected it to work as well as it did, but it wound up being pretty much a gift from the federal government in the sense that it gave the municipal world access to liquidity and the market that we would not have had otherwise. Now, the federal government didn't actually pay you more money than the bonds were actually worth. They get their money in taxes. They give part of it. We get the offsets to it. And when you consider the projects, there's been a lot of discussion of whether it was a subsidy or not. The simple fact is, in our case, it kept the projects going and got our financings done at a rate that was substantially below where we thought we'd be as we went into 2009. So the Build America program and $3.5 billion of it, literally at about, I think the average rate on that was about 450, literally gave us a fighting chance to finish within that term. To date, the federal government has made its payments, all of them on time, all $143 million. They've actually been a very good partner on it with, you know, only one minor hiccup, and the trustee dealt with that well before the debt service payments were coming in. Now, you see where those bars are going across the chart and where interest rates spiked up again. That's where we had the authority to work in 2010. And because interest rates spiked up and got close to 6% again, our feeling was we would sit it out and wait and see if the market would come back to us. As you can see where that blue line has come down, it is now just, oh, just a shade above some historic lows. We think that's going to hold for a little while, and that's why we're looking for the authority now to get the last part of the program finished well below our target rates at 575. Talk for just a minute about risk management, and this is dealing with what is the credit structures or what are the bank ratings related to our lines of credit, letters of credit, which actually support the variable rate bonds. Now, letters of credit are there for a very good reason. They allow funds and investors to take their bonds, literally put them back to their remarketing agents every week. They are guaranteed they will get a payment. That's relatively important in the short-term world, and that's what makes it work, and that's what keeps rates down. As you look at that box on the top right corner, those are the banks and the contract values we have with them that cover our letters of credit. Now, the long-term ratings of most of the banks being in the AAs or higher are in pretty decent shape. Where they get into single A's, Moody's has now come up with a structure, and that structure basically says that if their rating is A, their short-term rating now has to change. Well, this is the first time we've seen this. That would put them from what's called A1, P1, or F1, which are the highest short-term ratings, to what's called second-tier ratings. Well, the very funds that hold $1.5 billion of our bonds, instead of investing in all $1.5 billion, theoretically could only invest in about 3% of them. Moody's has said many things and has some articles out on what the impacts might be. The basic impacts of it can conceivably be substantially higher interest rates on a part of your portfolio. In our case right now, there's about $615 million that could be in question if those downgrades do happen. That would be Bank of America, Lloyd's, and Morgan Stanley. So what we plan to do is to take the Lloyd's and Morgan Stanley pieces, $305 million, and we are going to do what's called converting their mode. We are going to change them from a weekly reset where the bonds can be put in by the investor every week to somewhere between a 3- and 5-year reset. That means they will no longer have remarketing agents. They will no longer have lines of credit associated with them. The investors put the bonds every 5 years. The rate on that, at that range, versus the cost for remarketing and the line of credit are about the same. So, and we're trying to go out as far as to where we're cost neutral or slightly cost under. But that will be, we're going to do that in the relatively near future, which is why approving the information statement is in front of you now. That way we have marketing documents to go forward with. But when we get to that, once that's done, that will really only leave the Bank of America piece. And that piece, there are lots of other banks that do have high enough ratings that we could replace them relatively quickly. We wouldn't have to pay damages or anything. So we're going to take this as the first step. And then we have plenty of options with the rest of them. Should Moody's sort of carry out their intention of lowering these bank short-term ratings? If they don't, we'll be fine. Short-term rates are very low. The bonds are very effective, and we're very happy with the portfolio. Managing the debt portfolio is more than just the variable rate bonds and lines of credit. We do have a relatively significant swap portfolio remaining. We have about $1.5 billion in variable rate bonds. Associated with them is about $1.5 billion of contract swaps. Now, these are called derivative financial instruments. They are called derivative financial instruments for a very simple reason. Their interest rate on the contract is derived from either a contract or an index, not from the face of a bond. The same is exactly true on a variable rate mortgage. Variable rate mortgage is a derivative financing instrument because it's a contract rate and there is no rate on a bond or on the face of your mortgage. We have utilized these swaps since 2001. Initially, the size of the portfolio was about $3.5 billion. With the way things melted down in 2008, we restructured and we redid those. ultimately terminating the AMBAC components of them and making the payments to AMBAC of $105 million. And still, in all of that, what you can see on the board up there is the spread, the difference between the rates that we took advantage of in the contract market, the synthetic market, versus what you would have issued at on those given dates on in the standard fixed rate market. From a dollar standpoint, the difference between that is about, there's about, if we'd have issued all those bonds on those given days at fixed rates, our payments would have been about $225 million. With the contracts we had and the portfolio we have, they wind up being about $190 million. When you add costs onto that, that changes it to about $200 million, maybe a little more. So in essence, when you went in to this structured portfolio, the savings were about $25 million a year. After 2008, we took out a lot of variable rate bonds. We've restructured a lot of the portfolio, reduced the synthetic portfolio down to $1.5 billion. That savings goes down to about $10 million a year. But ultimately, it is still saving money over what you would have issued at, and that those savings have been worth about $90 million to date. Structurally, originally it would have been over $500 million. It still has a value of about $300 million for the life of the financing. Again, the contracts continue to function. Everybody is making the payments as they should make them. Even in the worst of the AMBAC days, AMBAC was still making the payments. So what we're looking at now is the way the contracts are structured, there is a mark-to-market, a value of the contract. At the moment, because interest rates are so very low, that value works against us. In other words, we would pay roughly $411 million if we wanted to terminate all the contracts right now. By perspective, that's about 20 cents on the toll, or about $25 million a year. What we're looking for is the opportunity to look at these as the market changes, as interest rates go up and the market changes, we would opportunistically refund them. But because the contracts are functioning the way they should, there's really no reason to terminate them or make payments until the market goes in your favor, and then you can make decisions on what you want to do with them. There's one last thing. Hang on just a second, Susan. One last thing that we are looking at as well. We the remarketings in 2008, those interest rates are some of the highest we have in our fixed rate portfolio. Right at the moment, it is not cost-effective to refund those bonds, but over the next year, we're sort of hoping that the market will get us to a point where it's cost-effective to refund some or all of those bonds. I know some of them are in what we call in the money right now, but we're not quite there yet. So we'll look at the swap portfolio, see what comes, but we're going to look at whether there's enough savings in refunding some of the fixed-rate bonds to see if we can drive these costs down even a little further over the next year. Now, as we're getting into the last phases of BATA's capital financing plan, and quite frankly, if everything goes according to Hoyle, this could be the last time we have to authorize a financing plan, at least for these projects. I don't know what the future will hold or new projects, but for what we started working on 10 years ago, we're now getting to the gun lab. One of the things that you have to be mindful of is we do finance, and when we first started, all of our financings were done in arrears, and we simply reimbursed ourselves. Now, with the market where it is, we could conceivably be financing somewhat in advance. That does bring federal arbitrage rules into play. My lawyer over here will tell you that we've never even gotten close to being worried about them. But it is something, when you finance in advance, you do have to make expenditure rules and drawdowns and things like that. Not particularly something we concern, but it's still something you have to talk about. The next thing over the next year, maybe even longer, gets to be bank downgrades. Now, the first thing everybody worries about is, what does this mean on your swap counterparties? Will they default on you? What will happen? The first thing that happens if a bank is downgraded to a certain level is they actually have to post collateral to us to protect what they owe us. So in the event they owe us money on a swap, they have to post collateral to do it. If the mark-to-market goes our way, anyway, they have to post collateral of a certain type. So that sort of protects you in the event they owe you money. On the line of credits, downgrades could certainly impact interest rates, and we have to be mindful of it, and we're going to be watching this pretty closely. Right at the moment, after we make these initial mode changes, we'll be looking at what Bank of America's ratings come to and what the market does with Bank of America. I think if we're at, Bob, you want to talk about rates for a minute?
Right now, and as you can imagine, we have a number of clients who are in the same position with respect to Bank of America, and rates now on the short end are still quite low. We're keeping an eye on Bank of America and how it's been trading, as well as some of these other banks. We noted, the trading values sort of move with the news. They had traded off a little bit from their traditional spreads to other banks. This is Bank of America for a bit, and this is, you know, since these are weeklies, that may be a week or two, and then all of a sudden they've tightened again as better news about Bank of America taking certain steps to enhance its credit, hits the market. They tighten, they widen a little, but right now they've been, you know, we've seen them as wide as maybe 8 to 10 to 12 basis points, depending on what news is in the marketplace. And what we've also found is that because Moody's has come out with this pronouncement about certain banks, that we're seeing, as Brian said, showed earlier, two ratings are required by money funds. We've seen clients moving to get a second rating. We have three ratings here at BATA, but a second rating from either Standard & Poor's and Fitch in order to make sure that their short-term securities are still money market eligible, even if Moody's were to downgrade somebody like a B of A. But even though they're still money market qualified, it's still going to have an impact on interest rates if Moody's acts on B of A or any of these other banks.
After the upcoming mode change.
Sorry. I got a question. It sounds counterintuitive that somebody's credit rating would be downgraded and then the rate to us would go up. Can you explain how that works?
Not the fee to us. Actually, Bank of America, in situations where we've worked with them to extend their credit facilities, has been accommodating on the fee, because you look at the price, the interest rate at which a Bank of America-backed bond trades in the marketplace. So a Bank of America-backed bond, because of their credit issues, are going to trade at a higher interest rate than, let's say, a J.P. Morgan, for example. So that's what Brian is talking about, the interest rate that BATA would pay as a result of having the Bank of America backstop. Yeah. The good news, though, is BATA is also still has to pay those bonds and is still the credit behind those bonds. So the investor is still looking to BATA, which happens to be rated higher than most of these banks. It's the short-term liquidity rating of the banks that comes into play with respect to the interest rate.
Okay, thank you.
Last pieces involve the swap terminations. Again, the negative carry, the mark-to-market on those, is a negative $411 million on the contracts. If they were terminated, if we terminated those and just financed the whole thing, it's about $27 million a year, 20 cents on the toll. The swaps are designed to go for the life of the financing. They're even sort of designed to survive bankruptcy proceedings. Nobody would want to get into that, but Lehman Brothers gave us a pretty good window that they do. So we're basically wait for the market to change, take opportunistic advantage of the market if it comes up. And otherwise, they've provided cost-effective money. It saved us money, helped provide projects, and we would continue to monitor them as we go along. And then finally, the federal payments. The federal government has made its payments on time, and they're showing no indication that they're not going to do it in the future. They seem to know their responsibilities as to the 30-year financings that were undertaken. And they, you know, as I said, the Treasury Department has sent most of the payments well in advance. So we're pretty happy with that. So that gets you to those are the sort of the what we're going to do, the do's and the don'ts, some of the risks. I will Pop back for just 1 second to that chart, Susan, will you? Keep going. One more. There. As I said in the beginning, if you look at that chart, we were working at a 5.25 interest rate target to finish these projects just a couple of years ago. At one point in time, we actually thought we had to have a 6.25 target. Now getting ready for this last financing, if you look at that 4.5% strike right there and go just about halfway up to 5, you will see that's where we expect to be. We don't beat the market. Nobody does. You try to beat the market, you have disasters. But we have used the market to take advantage of some areas, and in spite of all the turmoil and everything else, we have come out relatively well through all of it. And as I said, if you look at that strike below 5%, that's conceivably the end of the portfolio and the end of $11 billion worth of project financings. With what we've been through in the last couple of years, that's something to keep in mind as you're going forward. And people talk about what you were able to generate for this program. Now we'll get to the resolution. Relatively standard resolution with one slight exception. We normally ask for authority for about a year. In this case, we're asking for the authority to issue up to $1.2 billion worth of new money bonds and for about 20 months because we could wind up getting through $500 or $700 million of it and want to hang on for a little while. So we're taking it through to December of 13. The funding is relatively, the parameters are roughly the same as before. Underwriters' discounts, our costs are limited by your actions to 1% of the issuance, 2% for taxable bonds, legal costs and other financial advisory costs, which are invaluable, by the way, but are still limited to half of what everybody else gets. Maximum maturity will be 40 years. Interest rates are capped at 5.75% for tax-exempt bonds and 8% for taxable bonds. Again, taxable bonds would be a very limited use at that 8% strike. But it is something just in case over the next 18 months a certain program were to come back, we'd like to be in the position to take advantage of it. And the rest, authorize the information statement, which you have, execute the possible refundings. If the thresholds that are in the debt policy, that's renewed every year, which is basically 3% present value, are met. Terminate and or amend existing swap agreements. This happens when conditions are that, a counterparty's ratings go to a point where unhappy, we might switch over to a more highly rated counterparty, and we've done that a couple of times in the last couple of years. Convert the senior lien bonds to other interest rate modes. The documents call for it. It is somewhat in our own protections, especially as you deal with what has become, you know, a liquidity market that is full of product and plenty of capacity and still questions as to whether people will deliver it. And then amend, restructure, replace, or terminate the authority to reimbursement agreements. That will be the lines of credit that we'll be dealing with over the next couple of years. With that, that's the do's, the don'ts, and what we're asking for. We'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much for the presentation and all the work that's gone into this. I have to admit that I'm certainly not an expert in terms of how the market works and in dealing with this industry. But I also know that when it comes to this market and this industry, the experts have been wrong before. And so I'm wondering if you can tell me worst-case scenario, assuming that everything that you said, you know, we have anticipated goes the other way. I mean, what can we expect in terms of this money for the toll payers?
Well, to start with, if things go the other way, the first thing we do is what we did in 2010 and just stand down. We won't do anything. If the market moves counter to what we think are our best interests, we simply don't issue the bonds. We saw that in 2010. 2011 interest rates simply went too far up. They got too questionable. Same thing happened with the lines of credit after 2011. The market needed to adjust itself. There was a period where certain documents of the past no longer worked in the current market. They needed to get to a new product. It looked virtually the same to everybody else, but the investors sort of demanded something new. So we stayed away from it until this all settled itself down. If interest rates go spiking up, we'll stay away from them. If interest rates get to a certain parameter where we can use variable rates, then we'll use that.
Can you give us a little bit more information about how that process would work? I mean, how do you decide when you stand down or, you know, when you walk away? When, you know, how does that happen? And what is the level of involvement of this board in as that decision happens?
Oh, I wish I could give you a really good answer for that, like there's some magic formula we use. There really isn't. I think it. The first thing is that we have a very good financing team. I have, you know, a lot of people and an awful lot of advice every day on what to do. But as we go in, for example, as you're giving the authority this month, that we'll look at what any change in the market. We run models now on various contingencies up to 100 years. We can literally, even through my own models, we can literally run in a change in interest rates, a change in costs, a change in project costs, financing structures, and we can see what it does to the model. But if the model stays within the authorizing parameters and we stay within the strikes of the toll structure, generally speaking, we have the authority to do it, but if it gets to where it's getting too close, generally speaking, we'll call it off. Now, the only time we moved counter to that, which was within authority, was 2008 when we had to take out some bonds and refinance them.
Well, now, I was going to say, what often drives our decision-making, like any project, is when you need the money. And so if you need the money, you have sometimes very little choice as to what market you enter. You know, we then look at what the timing is as to when the money is needed to apply to construction, look at the markets, and then the finance team, all of whom have interest rate views, try to enter the, you know, talk to Brian and Sue about what might be the optimal time to enter the market, whether it's better to enter now or to wait, whether it's better to enter with certain products versus other products, and what the risks and rewards of those products are, which is sort of what we've been doing since the beginning. Less of an immediate need because of BATA's cash position to enter the market. So we were able to, ride out 2011 because there weren't as many cash demands with respect to the project. Had that been different, we might have entered that market had there been, you know, cash demands, because the one thing we didn't want was for the project to suffer and slow down as a result.
So in terms of the role that the board has and that, I'm wondering if you can just speak a little bit to that.
Commissioner Steve Heminger, Executive Director. Susan, could you put the slides back up? And the last one on the parameters. Commissioner, the way that we have done it in the past doesn't have to be the way we do it going forward, but the way we've done about $9 billion worth of debt is you set parameters that you have to feel comfortable with, and we operate within those parameters. What you've heard from Brian and Bob, I think, is a discussion about when we're getting close to those parameters, mm-hmm. even though we're authorized, do we really want to go ahead? And I think the judgment they've exercised has been pretty good over the years, because you've got an all-in rate for that $9 billion of under 4.5%. So I think your focus ought to be these parameters. And if you are not comfortable with them, you ought to debate them and change them. If you're comfortable with them, this is our running room. And, you know, we are authorized to use all of it. I think in my memory, and I've been here throughout all of these financings, we've never really come close to most of the major parameters in terms of interest rates or other things. So if you'd like to tighten them up a bit, that's clearly an issue for you to debate. But I think the parameters are where you exert your discipline and your control, and once you establish them, then these guys are off to the races.
And I let me just say that I don't believe that we should be micromanaging this process. I agree that I think it has to be about the parameters that are set out, and I don't personally have a problem with the parameters. I just want to have a sense of how the process works. You know?
I do also want to emphasize Bob's point. Our history in this program has been reimbursable, right? We have spent the money, and when we've got a bunch of it spent, we go out and sell debt and reimburse ourselves. There's no arbitrage risk at all. Brian used the phrase opportunistic, and that's what we're doing in this case. The market appears at this point to be so favorable in terms of rates that we're willing to do and consider a forward financing where we don't have all the money spent yet, but the rate is good enough that it's probably worth getting it. But if the rates go the other direction, we've still got plenty of money in the bank that we can spend on the projects. You know, we're not going to send the hard hats home. We've got enough to keep them moving, and if we have to go back to the old way of waiting to reimburse, we can. So this is an unusual financing in that we're trying to take advantage of a market really with our last tranche of debt. And if we do, good for us. If we don't, we can go back to what we did with the first several tranches, and that's wait till we spend all the money.
Thank you. I do have a final question, and it's more of a point, and I don't know exactly that anything needs to be done now, but I do think it's something that we as a commission have to think about. If you look at at page 4 of the presentation and the banks that we're doing business with, and again, not to single out any one bank, but I know that, for instance, in San Francisco, we are dealing right now to a lesser extent than other parts of the Bay Area, but we are dealing with a foreclosure crisis. And our assessor recorder just did a very brief review and study of about 400 foreclosures in San Francisco. And the third-party independent auditor found a number of irregularities. I think 84% of the foreclosures had some questionable action on the part of the bank. And obviously, we have a financial responsibility to make sure that we manage this toll revenue in the most effective way and to maximize the revenue for the toll payers. That said, we are doing business with some of the institutions that are playing a role in this foreclosure crisis. And I think that at some point we are going to have to deal with that and address that, because to the extent that we have money with these institutions, I do think that we have a responsibility to make sure that we impact how they're doing business in other areas. So I just want to put that issue out there, because I know that is something that is a real concern in San Francisco, certainly the part of San Francisco that I represent. And at some point, you're going to have to deal with that. And, you know, maybe in the end, people choose to look the other way. But I think it's something that should be discussed. Thank you.
Commissioner, just maybe one point on that, and maybe not to get directly to that issue. And we can certainly follow up with the assessor in San Francisco or elsewhere. But what Brian is recommending to you is to try to reduce the role that these banks play. I mean, we do live in a bit of a topsy-turvy world now. The AmBac episode we went through, we bought insurance from AmBac because they were higher rated than we were. They ended up being several notches below us. As I think Bob said, or Brian, most of these banks are rated lower than we are. So the exposure is actually in the other direction. And I think it's in our own self-interest, frankly, to try to reduce that exposure. Because this is an industry, to say the least, that's shown a little volatility lately. I think it would be better for all of us for it to settle out so we know who's going to be left standing. In the meantime, I think our liquidity, the fact that we've got most of our debt issued, and the fact that I think Brian's hit upon an idea that can reduce our exposure to these letters of credit, we ought to pursue all of that as well.
Just as a follow-up on that, on this $1.2 billion, in these parameters, either 5.75 for tax-exempt or 8 for taxable, if you ended up going to the max, would that have any impact on tolls?
No, that 5.5 and 3 quarters is our limit without impacting the structure.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. We're looking then for a motion to approve Resolution 103.
So moved.
We have a motion. Is there a second?
Second.
And a second. Any discussion? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? That motion passes unanimously. Thank you, Brian. Team. We'll move now to item number 4. Brian, this is you again, huh? Credit card processing and banking services for Fast Track?
Yes, sir. Still Brian Mayhew. We don't have a presentation on this, so we'll start to make it quick on you. As you know, our toll system runs on a number of electronic toll collections and prepaid toll structures. It's about, you know, what, 55% of our volume. Roughly 65 million cars require some sort of credit card processing. We went to bid this year for our credit card processor. The current one is Bank of America. We went to bid for credit card processors. We have a number of sort of minimum qualifications we've listed in here for you. But the main ones being that they had to have some asset base that we could count on of $5 billion and mostly requirements, very stringent requirements for what's called PCI certification, which is the security structures that protect the credit card holder with the credit card processor. We got 7 respondents after interviews and after discussions. The recommendation of the panel, and they were reviewed by both us and members of Golden Gate, was to go ahead and go with Bank of America as our current provider. Bank of America did make some pricing concessions during the bid process, roughly worth about $12,000, $13,000 a year to us. We'll talk to them a bit more before we actually sign the contract, so we think there might be some room there. Let me just say, Bank of America, they have done a fine job, and they are setting a standard for PCI and customer security compliance. And for the moment, this is given that some of the breaches between 2005 and now that have been relatively serious. We do think that this is a very important aspect of the credit card processing. Therefore, we'll ask you to recommend Bank of America for a new contract. It runs about $10 million a year. We can't tell you exactly how much it will be, but we'll cap it at 10, and if it goes over that, we'll come ask. But basically, if traffic goes up, we'd have to come and get more authorization. But right now, about $10 million a year.
Okay, question. Commissioner Cortese?
Just a question, and my intention is not, at least at this moment, to do anything in terms of folding up this item, but back to the previous discussion on the previous item, I'm wondering what it would take to add, you know, a social responsibility criteria or lens to what we're doing, you know, with the banking industry on an ongoing basis or on a going forward basis, because I mean, there's enough. I don't know what the track record is of all these banks, but there were enough respondents. You know, it just strikes me as it's possible that there are some folks here that are more responsible in terms of the public policy issues that we have to deal with in our home counties, be it San Francisco, Santa Clara, whatever. I know that we're tackling the same kind of issue in Santa Clara County right now. It sounds like San Francisco's well into it. I just think it would be worth pursuing, and I wanted to bring it up while we're on an item that actually touches upon, you know, utilizing banks as vendors here. Maybe that's a rhetorical question. Maybe what I should just ask is for at some point MTC staff to get back to us and let us know whether that be in a privileged matter or whether that be in appropriately in a public manner. I don't know, but to let us know what it would take to at least have a criteria that brings that issue up each time, surfaces the issue each time.
Commissioner, maybe I could suggest, since this seems to be an emerging theme, that we could at least do some due diligence for you working around the region just to get a sense of this foreclosure issue to start with. and also maybe reaching out to some of the other toll authorities and issuers around the country and seeing what they're doing on the subject, and bring you back that report so you can think further about it and maybe consider some options.
That would be appreciated.
Would that be agreeable?
We're going to put it forward.
Okay. Commissioner Green first.
You know, I certainly can appreciate the pressure that some commissioners might feel about adding on the social equity component in choosing banks that we're going to be dealing with here, although, frankly, I'm not necessarily one of them. You know, wading into this muddy atmosphere of what's even the definition of social equity, which is always a fascinating one, which no one around this table has ever actually defined for me, I might add. But, you know, I think that our job here is to get things done as efficiently as possible. Not dealing with criminals, I'll admit that. But, again, I don't necessarily think that even though we've had allusions to names here, or allusions to banks without actually naming anybody, although this is getting pretty close to naming one right here, I would caution restraint and actually to refrain from, again, pulling in this ambiguous, vague definition of whatever social equity might mean. I'm sure we could write 20 definitions of it right around the table here. And I just think that we might be spending time better in other directions rather than adding on social equity as a financial criteria to BATA.
Commissioner Wirth?
Yeah, I just wanted to follow up with regards to this proposal. So I'm not sure. First of all, I want to understand, is it your recommendation that we act on this today and look in the future, or that we take this proposal and set it aside and come back with more information?
What I was suggesting, Commissioner, is the former, not the latter, that okay. We approve this,
okay.
And that if you so direct us today, and certainly the issue, as Commissioner Green indicates, is not without some controversy,
okay.
Because obviously you've
okay.
got very significant fiduciary responsibilities with these bridges,
okay.
And I don't think anyone's
okay.
suggesting that we tamper with that. The question is, can this be layered
okay.
into it?
Okay, I understand that. I think that we have a very different situation here. We are purchasing a product versus selling a bond. You know, that there are some differences and nuances here. And I guess what I would like to see with this proposal, I know that in other situations, for example, with the building, when we had our meeting last month, we got a very detailed analysis of the matrix that was used to rank and evaluate, you know, proposers of a contract before we made the decision. And so I guess one of the things I'd like to know is, you mentioned the criteria, and again, this is not an attempt to micromanage. I think that when we're going to spend this kind of money, and it's just, you know, we can choose where we want to spend the dollars. So I'd like to have a better understanding of how these different banks ranked in terms of the criteria. I'd like to also understand what I know Bank of America is the firm that's currently providing our credit card services. So what was their position in terms of offering us? You mentioned some additional consideration, a reduction in their fees. I mean, I know the credit card industry is extremely competitive right now, and I think it's incumbent upon us to not only get excellent services, but really to look at these vendors that are providing services and get the very best, both operational and financial value for our toll payers. So I guess I wondered if you could give me, you know, what was the range in terms of the ranking? Were they way out, or were they close? Or can you give us a little bit more detail in terms of how all these banks fell in terms of the matrix?
Well, as far as the rankings were concerned, Bank of America and Wells Fargo were the number one and two banks. There was no real, there really wasn't a clear third place winner. Especially given the level of volume we have to have and the level of security we have to have.
Right.
Those were the two, based on all of the criteria, those were the two biggest of the banks. I think as far as the proposals themselves and services are offered, I think that they're all roughly about equal. They would really, especially Bank of America, Wells Fargo, and Bank of the West, which is a little smaller and an up-and-comer in the credit card processing business, having that size and capacity to do that volume is a very, very limited group of people. And that's a – then you combine that with the security. I don't think we saw anybody that had security violation issues to deal with. So that one sort of came and went. But I would say basically over on all the criteria above, Bank of America, Wells Fargo were clearly the number one and two banks in the proposals.
So if I could just follow up. So it sounds like Bank of America, Wells Fargo, similar in terms of the operational issues. All those things are both big banks. They deal with big numbers like this. So how about price point? If we're going to be authorizing the executive director to go back and negotiate a contract, is there an opportunity to continue to look at what we're going to be paying for these services in terms of getting the best value out of a contract?
We will continue to go back and talk to Bank of America about the pricing. That's not fixed yet. They all gave us indicative pricing. All of it was relatively close. And I would say Wells Fargo was probably a little better off pricing-wise than Bank of America. But overall, the Bank of America proposal just, I mean, they made the concessions. It was a better proposal. And given our security requirements, they seem to be the ones best to handle it. But again, that what the contract is not set in stone. We actually expect wherever the contract goes that they're going to match whatever the lowest offer is.
I'm going to go around. Just on that, I think what I got from Commissioner Worth there, and I kind of agree that you kind of set a standard here with staff on a lot of bids where you come up with the rating, and on this one you don't. So it's kind of inconsistent on how
Chairman,
we do that.
I take that criticism to heart, and okay. We're going to fix that so that you see something a little more standardized whenever you see a contract, whether it's for $10 million or $100,000.
Very good. Thank you. Commissioner Haggerty?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to associate myself with Commissioner Green's comments. I want to be as very delicate as possible because there is a lot of people losing their homes right now, and I certainly, feel for them. But I'm just not sure that here at MTC, when we have a fiduciary responsibility to the ratepayers, people who are paying the tolls, and we also have a responsibility to get these projects done. I think that it's really important that we realize that we can't solve here at MTC all the troubles of the world. And I realize, we have to be somewhat sensitive. But I also believe that when we're talking the amount of dollars that we're talking here, and credit cards, projects, whatever, we have to associate ourselves with some of the major institutions because they're the ones that have the money. And so I understand what Commissioner Campos is talking about. I applaud what he's saying, and I applaud San Francisco for the work that they're doing. I think that we at MTC have to be careful, and we have to stay focused to our mission.
Commissioner Campos?
Thank you very much. And I want to thank again staff for the work and the presentation. And I don't have a problem moving forward with this item. And I do think that the additional information that was discussed is something that would be useful going forward. I don't think that this is about solving all of the world's problems. And I do think that the focus has to be in our fiduciary responsibility. But I don't think that's necessarily inconsistent with thinking responsibly about how the people that we do business with are doing, not only nationally, but also with our own residents. I think that there is a way that you meet those fiduciary responsibilities and still think about those issues. And it's not necessarily that we don't do business with some of these entities, but that to the extent that you are doing business with them, you might actually be able to influence some of the things that they do. And I think that at a minimum, we should think about this. And it's something that I think requires more discussion. And I think it's really about striking the balance between the various interests. And following up on what Commissioner Cortese said, I think that having more information on this issue from staff would be very helpful. And based on that information, we can figure out, where we go from there and whether or not there is a policy, for instance, that needs to be put in place. But I do think it's something that is worth talking about and thinking about. And I don't think that The fact that we have a fiduciary responsibility means that we cannot do this at the same time. I think that they're not mutually exclusive. But I appreciate the thoughts, and I certainly respect the perspective that Commissioners Green and Commissioner Haggerty have. Thank you.
Commissioner Bates?
Well, excuse me, very briefly, I agree with the speaker just before me that I don't think it's a problem. I think we have a fiduciary relationship. We don't need to violate that. We need to look at that. We need to make sure that all those T's are crossed and I's are dotted, and we look at that through those lenses. And then after that, after we're confident that people meet those criteria, then the next question is, what about social aspect of it? So I think it can be done, and I don't think it's going to add any great burden. And I appreciate the Director Imager saying that they've been looking into this because I think it's possible. I know San Francisco is looking at this. Berkeley's looking at this. Other people are looking at this. I mean, we'll have the same idea, same kind of thing. We're trying to make sure make sure our money's handled properly and appropriately, but we also think that in addition to that, there is a responsibility for some social responsibility.
Okay, any other comments? See any? So I'm looking for a motion to approve this credit card processing and banking services for FastTrack.
So moved.
We have a motion. Is there a second?
Second.
Any further discussion? Seeing none. Any dissent? That motion passes without objection. Thank you for that discussion. All right, Peter.
I'll be very brief, Commissioner. Peter Lee with Battis Staff. Just a quick update on the East Span. We were successful in completing our main cable. We successfully pulled the last of 137 strands last week. This is the last haul the ironworkers put a flag on as they pulled the last strand up and over the tower. And since that time, they've all been attached to the anchorage. And just to be really brief, the last activity that we have, we started cable hauling of the 137 strands late last year, just after Christmas. And like I said, we finished about a month earlier. So they're definitely on schedule right now to meet our Labor Day 2013 schedule. And our next major activity for the cable right now is compaction of the cable to remove all the voids that are in it right now. So 137 strands, 127 individual wires in each one of those. And what we'll have is the compactor go down and squeeze basically all the voids out of it and then wrap it with a steel band and tie it into one solid cable. It's a similar process that's happened in all other suspension bridges, and that's our next major activity on the bridge.
Peter, I think it's worthy of noting that, as I recall, this was one of the biggest risks with the design of this bridge at the onset because it hadn't been done this way before in this wrap, so that's pretty good news.
Yes. So, first time ever, single cable, self-synchronous.
Good knowledge. Mark, did you have
something?
I'm done.
I just wanted to bring one point of it. It's somewhat related to this. On the bridge seismic strategy status, page 17, I was just looking through the different bridges there, the no collapse, intermediates, lifeline. I had one question and one comment. I realize it's not with us, but what would we term the status of the Golden Gate Bridge right now? Would it be under a no-collapse lifeline or intermediate? Does anybody know that question?
Commissioner, I'll let Andy answer the question about what, if he knows, what standard they're retrofitting to. But I think the important point is it's not finished. They have finished the work on the two approaches, but the main span, the center span, is not yet complete.
So we wouldn't even call that into a no collapse?
Right this minute it's vulnerable,
okay.
Just like the East Span is.
All right.
Andy, do you know what standard they're shooting at? It's a non-Caltrans bridge, and those terms you're using are
I know
California terms of art.
Commissioner Green, my assumption would be that they're going towards a lifeline-type strategy, partially because of the type of bridge it is. It's easier to get there with the suspension bridge, but we can certainly check and get back to you.
And the second the comment I had on this was that, again, looking at the seven bridges that we have control of, so to speak, I'm looking at that, Venetia Martinez Lifeline, the Bay Bridge getting to a Lifeline, certainly those make sense. And I see that the no collapse has been applied to Antioch and Richmond, sort of the lower tier, I guess, which then gets me to the point that in the two bridges crossing the northern part of the region from Venetia and Carquinez, we have one Lifeline and one intermediate, which I guess you got to make a choice. And what I'm seeing, though, in the middle part, which somewhat concerns me, is that, to me, it would be nice to get, and I guess we need to get the numbers as what it would take to do this, one of the two bridges going from the East Bay to the peninsula, I think needs to be looked at as what it would take to upgrade that to a Lifeline, because they're both at Dumbarton, as well as the San Mateo bridges are both at intermediate. And do we have any idea what it would take to do at least one of them to get? And I'm not saying which one, but I do think that one of those needs to be at some point, you know, lifted up to that other status, because otherwise we're looking at a 50-mile detour to get to San Francisco, much not to mention the peninsula. I mean, either you hook around the South Bay or you go over the Bay Bridge, and there's nothing in between. So I'm just wondering, do we have any figures on what it would take to get one of those two to a Lifeline structure status?
Commissioner, the director answer to your question is Brian would get to issue more bonds because the retrofit work's been complete. So going back in and choosing a higher standard is a significant piece of work. I will say, too, and I don't think your question implies this, but I want to make sure it's clear to everybody listening, those standards do not reflect our level of affection for those bridges or the people who use them. The scenario that's been described to me, and I need to be quite candid about this, is that in the event of a major earthquake, the search and rescue teams land at Travis Air Force Base, and they need to find a way to get to San Francisco. And so they need the Benicia Bridge and the San Francisco-Oakland Bay Bridge. It's that specific. And you're right that there would be a significant detour on the peninsula, but detours can happen in an earthquake. There's really no detour that gets you to San Francisco.
Well, I'm not really arguing at that point. It's just that, you know, we talked here in the same room in another agency about recovery and resiliency and everything else. And if you're looking at economic resiliency for the Bay Area, you know, not having any access to the peninsula, to the East Bay for 50 miles, besides just transportation, in a broader context of the economy, I think brings up some real questions. So, again, I think it's worthwhile pick which one it is. It doesn't matter to me. The San Mateo Bridge probably makes more sense. But one of those two bridges I think we need to take a look at is what it would take to get it up to that upper tier. That's what I may be the only one around the table who thinks that, but I had to air that out.
Very good. Okay, thank you for that. I don't have any speaker cards for public comment. Seeing none, we will adjourn this meeting to the next meeting, which will be Wednesday, May 9, 2012 at 9:30.